Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll look back at two retailers who were at their best during the holiday shopping season. Marshall Fields on State Street in Chicago became a destination for shoppers this time of the year, creating memories for generations. The same was true for Bergner's, a chain that got its start in Peoria. Both those iconic names are now gone, but we'll talk about their history. It's been a difficult year for school kids. Some school social workers will join us to explain the toll the pandemic has taken on students. And we have a report from Springfield where various community leaders discuss the year that was, from the pandemic to the push for social justice.
People in the community were coming out on their porches and they were waving and they were smiling. You know, it's like they were being seen for the first time.
What are their hopes for 2021? All that and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from community leaders in Springfield about the lessons learned in 2020 and what they're looking for in the year ahead. We'll also hear about holiday traditions of two retailers, Bergner's and Marshall Fields, which are no longer around. That and more still to come. Well, first up this week, students spent the entire fall either learning from home or going in person on a limited hybrid schedule. Peter Medlin checked in with school social workers he spoke to back in August about the emotional and academic toll the pandemic has taken on students.
Are you there?
Jen Katowski types into the Google Meet chat box. Still no response. Then, finally, a new message pops up from the student on her caseload. Katowski is a social worker for DeKalb High School. The student has their camera and microphone off, so the chat box is the only way to talk right now. Those are the most challenging meetings she has with students, and at this point, she's used to talking to high schoolers with their camera off.
I talked to a student yesterday. Her avatar is actually a picture of her. And then other kids, like I have a kid whose avatar is a piece of pizza.
It can be hard for social workers to connect online with the students they serve. A sizable portion of the 45 students on her caseload are freshmen who have never met her and haven't even been inside the high school yet. Typically, she sees them once a week, but some have refused to and she talks to them less often. The DeKalb School District has been remote for the entire fall, and like other schools, the district briefly brought back a small number of students with extra needs before having to return them to remote learning. Katowski says it can be too much for those students, even though they might benefit the most from in-person instruction.
I understand like the idea and purpose behind bringing them back, but to have them continue to transition back and forth is very challenging and just really not good for them.
In Sycamore, the district slowly brought back even more students, especially at younger levels. Then they started seeing positive cases and over 300 people under quarantine. The DeKalb County Public Health Department soon advised all schools in the county to go online again. Sycamore High School counselor Crystal Templin sees how disheartening it can be this far into the pandemic.
They had a little taste of it for a couple weeks, and then now it's hard because it's like you know what it could be.
Educators are trying to find ways to keep students engaged. Katowski says she doesn't think they're doing well enough helping students connect with their peers in the classroom, which can be difficult in a Google Meet full of faceless dark squares. Some teachers have taken on offering extra credit for having your camera on. Katowski's continued to offer self-care strategies and mindfulness techniques. She has a Google site where students can listen to soothing music or learn how to make a stress ball. It's tough to encourage walks outside in winter as temperatures plummet. And she has some students that meet with her online in small groups, which she says is also beneficial. But Katowski says the burnout, distractions, and lack of social interaction are having a profound effect on academic performance.
They're almost more willing to meet with me than they are to go to class.
Many of her students are at risk of not graduating on time.
I feel like a lot of my job is focused on helping the kids figure out what they need to do to bring their grades up so that they pass, because a lot of my seniors are failing multiple classes at this point.
The social-emotional lessons, focus on topics like defense mechanisms, she's pushed out to teachers, are appreciated, but it's a challenge to get students to attend. In Sycamore, social worker Mary Ellen Spicer says some students are excelling, and they're seeing success with peer-to-peer tutoring.
We're matching up students who may have strengths in areas of English and history, or those who have strengths in math and science, then matching them up with students who are struggling academically.
And kids' normal high school problems haven't gone away either.
We still have students who have a breakup of a relationship or a parent who's clinically ill. We have students who are struggling with financial difficulties.
those issues can sometimes be sharpened by the pandemic. And Katovsky says working remotely has made it more difficult to meet with general education students who aren't Hunter caseload, but who would normally just stop by her office. Many Northern Illinois schools like DeKalb and Sycamore plan to be remote until early 2021. But with the holidays looming and case counts increasing, some parents and educators fear it could be longer. And as they navigate the situation, students and teachers are just trying to keep their heads above water. But it's clear to those working with them that the academic and emotional ramifications of this pandemic will extend far beyond the eventual return to the classroom. I'm Peter Medlin.
Holiday shopping has changed through the years. Now the internet dominates, but there was a time when going to a big department store was the norm and even part of the holiday experience. Bergner's was one of those stores. It's gone now, the chain having closed locations throughout Illinois and elsewhere in 2018. Bergner's got its start in Peoria well over a century ago. Steve Tarter, a longtime Peoria reporter, joins us to talk about Bergner's, which began operations in the city's downtown and competed against its rival, Block and Cool, for years.
Bergner's was right alongside there. Macy's and Gimbel's is back in the news, so that was kind of the case here in Peoria as well.
So they were rivals, is a good way to put it?
Yeah, although I don't know that the... You know, not having seen them in their heyday, the man that came and really helped the Bergner's, Tom Liston, he came there in the late 50s as their head, as their manager, CEO. I know in an interview he gave to the paper years before I got there, he said, you know, he looked longingly across the street at the store there, because even in the 50s, and of course, you know, retail was still going strong as we, you know, kind of knew it. People went to the store to get what you needed. That was still a very strong store. And it was a big store. It was six floors high, and Bergner's was a little smaller. They had two great department stores. And when I came to Bradley in the late 60s, 67, we'd go downtown. And at that time, the Block and Cool had become Carson Perry Scott. And you still had Bergner's. So you had your choice where to buy those bell-bottoms, either one or you go across the street to buy the other.
So Bergner's was big in Peoria, but it hadn't quite gotten the attention probably outside of the city as much. What really took place to make that change?
I think there are two things. I think the growth that Bergner's saw was, and how much, you know, other players, you know, contributed, you know, we don't always know, because I'm sure there are a great many individuals that played a part in it, but you had two things that we do know about, and that's, as I mentioned, Tom Liston taking over, and here was a guy who had been at Bloomingdale's in New York and Mandel Brothers in Chicago, and then he took over Bergner's, and they grew under his time. But you also had the ownership of Bergner's was a Swiss department store holding company, if I'm pronouncing right, Moe's Frères. Moe's Brothers, if you you know, translate to French, and that Swiss outfit, they were pretty fast moving. I mean, they wanted to see things happen at Bergner's, and they did. They expanded. As I said, Liston, when he took over in '58, I think the sales were about $8 million. When he retired in '83, it was up to $200 million, and they had like 25 outlets across the state. Certainly around the Peoria area. I think they even got into Wisconsin for a store or two, but that was their peak in the early 80s. And then, of course, as we know, things changed quite a bit after that. And, you know, the erosion began, shall we say.
We're talking with Steve Tarter. He's a journalist who has covered Peoria for years, and we're talking about the Bergner's chain. Steve, you mentioned the 1980s. That was a big shift for Bergner's as well, because the headquarters, if I'm not mistaken, moved out of Peoria at that time?
Yes, and they moved to Milwaukee. It was a time, and I think this is probably nationally, it was going on, and it was represented here in Peoria, but you had acquisitions being made. I think Bergner's acquired the Boston store chain, and with that came some of the other stores, and they realigned. And unfortunately, you know, we like to look at the internet as the sort of the retail killer, But you have to remember, too, that the department store, which we always hold so dear at this time of year because of the history that it had, that was also getting stiff competition from discount stores across the nation, where people would go to different stores, you know, smaller stores. They weren't necessarily going into a fancy store, if we can use that word. And so this was part of the erosion. It wasn't just, we don't go into the store anymore for you know, the reason we're in front of a computer. It was other things, and this was driving the business there. And a lot of these stores were changing names and rearranging things. And of course, the expansion that occurred, and we saw it here in Peoria. You had stores in multiple shopping centers around town, and then across in Pekin and other communities, Galesburg certainly, we talked about them, where, you know, they were doing good business because they were the department store in those areas. But once the department store kind of became a little old and old-fashioned, or whatever the right term would be, the fall from grace was upon us.
Bergner's came under some financial pressure in the early 90s. Didn't it file for bankruptcy?
Right. Filed for bankruptcy and then eventually liquidation, because in 2018, which we would never have been conceived back in its heyday, when people would, you know, at this time of year talk about the talking Christmas tree and the store windows that were always decorated for the season. You would never have thought this chain or this store would have had the problems that eventually, of course, have befallen many in the retail area.
Yeah, we've seen the bigger chains, the Montgomery Wards, Sears, a lot of these stores that were just generations had shopped at. They're having all of these problems. You mentioned 2018, that was the final blow for Bergner's.
That was the final blow, and it was a case where, you know, and it's funny, right now in Peoria, which, of course, it was where Bergner's got its start, there seems to be a reluctance to let it go, because at one of the places, the shops at Grand Prairie, one of the outdoor malls where Bergner's had moved a large store to some years back, they still got the sign up there. You know, it's no longer, I think it's selling mattresses now, but on the side of the building is in their logo. Still appears very prominently. It's almost like, you know, we hate to see it come down because of what it meant in this community for so many years.
Yeah, just what did it mean for Peoria? Certainly when these types of stores, we had one in Springfield, there, of course, in other locations around the state, but, you know, they're just a tenant in some cases in a mall, but Bergner's in Peoria, that was a different story.
It was, because, you know, it was your own. And Bergner's had a style that I think was recognized, you know, sort of by not just the people that you know, shopped here, lived here, because that was convenient for them, but I think it resonated outside this area, and that style was they were making changes. You know, they saw the need to grow. These are articles that I remember reading. I took no part in them because they happened before I got to the paper, but I remember reading these articles in our library at the Journal Star about Liston talking about how a department store was theater, and you had to perform, sort of every day, put on a show, and so you keep things lively. He's the one, and again, maybe this was going on throughout the retail industry, I don't know, but he, I think in the 70s, he was wanting to make sure that items were there out in the store for people just to pick up. In another era, you would go to a counter and somebody would go and fetch what you wanted, a sweater, a dress, or a shirt, whatever it was. No, he was there, put it out there, let people pick it up, pay for it. You had to make, you know, we think of that now as sort of, well, you know, of course. Well, it wasn't always that way. And, you know, he modernized the store. He made it easy to get around, provided sort of things like a tea room. That goes back many years, where you had a distinctive place to dine when you were in the store. Some folks here in Peoria would remember Peanut Butter Heaven at the Sheridan Village store, which, you know, again, an example of Bergner's kind of seeing the need for change. They went from the downtown. They stayed in the downtown, but they didn't close that downtown store until the 80s. But the Sheridan Village store, they moved to what amounts to a shopping center in 1957. So they're among the first ones to see, okay, people want to park free, walk out to a number of stores. So Bergner's took advantage of that along with the old-style department store. They were doing it both ways.
How does a store that seemed so ahead of the game and almost revolutionary in some ways, how does that get to a point where it falls behind?
Well, I think, you know, and I think this has been repeated where, you know, the competition and also the acquisitions. I mean, when you're bought up by another firm, you know, initially Bergner's did the buying, but then they were bought up. And I think, you know, when that, you no longer had the chain of command that you had when it was doing so well here in Peoria. You had the, you know, say, if we give Liston the credit that I think he deserves, you know, he was able to kind of run his own ship, if you will, and many ships under the Bergner's name. That isn't the same when you've got a larger, more corporate ownership situation. And then, you know, Peoria is just one store among many. And, you know, we've seen that happen across other businesses. So I think it happened with the retail where you didn't have, you know, you can't go marching up to the office and say, why don't you do this? And you know, somebody says, okay, maybe we will. You don't have that kind of access. And, you know, as a result, we lose out. And obviously there's benefits to the corporate approach, but sometimes it doesn't always work out.
Reporter Steve Tarter in Peoria. We've been talking about Bergner's department stores, which had a long tradition that started in that city. The chain closed in 2018. And a bit later in today's program, we'll recall another tradition, holiday shopping at the former Marshall Fields in Chicago. Still on the way, Springfield leaders talk about the future as we look back at what was an eventful year in the capital city. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. As the University of Illinois plans to expand its COVID-19 saliva test program to other campuses, one small college says the program is working for them. Greenville University began using the U of I Shield program at the start of the fall semester on the Southern Illinois campus. As of last week, they see about 64 undergraduate students tested positive for the virus. Becky Smith is a U of I epidemiologist. She says the data shows the U of I's SHIELD program limits the spread of the coronavirus both on a large and very small college campus.
If nothing else, this program works given the circumstances we're in. What I'd love to see it is spread wider so that we can see what will happen if SHIELD is not just on campus.
Smith says the U of I is working hard to implement the program across the state and the country. U of I officials acknowledged at a state Senate hearing this week the test still doesn't have FDA emergency use authorization, and they need that authorization or an executive order from the governor's office for most of the state's colleges and K-12 schools to be able to use the test.
For NPR Illinois, I'm Mary Hansen. A pandemic, a civil rights uprising, economic turmoil, a historic election, this year has brought many hardships. It has made the inequalities and divisions in our society more clear. Illinois Times and NPR Illinois asked Springfield community leaders about their reflections on the year and what they hope changes. Here's some of what we heard.
My name is Dr. Wendy Wills Elamine, and I'm the Associate Dean of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, and I'm also a family physician. This year has really been hard because we're in a season where we have just seen insurmountable trauma, a level of pain with people being isolated, a level of pain where they have witnessed the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery. All of this together with COVID. When I was reflecting about poignant experiences in 2020, one of the things that came up was the Black Lives Matter motorcade. People in the community were coming out on their porches and they were waving and they were smiling. You know, it's like they were being seen for the first time. And I think that that type of solidarity is what's going to help Springfield. I've been looking at the Japanese art kintsugi. It's a bowl or a piece of pottery that has been broken and all the pieces are everywhere. And so what they do, instead of just discarding the pieces, they take gold and they bring that piece back together and then you develop something new. I feel like that's what's happening. Sometimes we have to break it all apart and bring it back together. And to me, 2020 was the part that put all the pieces down. And now we're putting the gold in between there so that we can say we've developed something new that has greater value.
My name is Sunshine Clemens. I am co-founder and co-president of Black Lives Matter Springfield chapter.
Hello, I'm Corianne Reedus, co-founder and co-president of Black Lives Matter Springfield chapter.
If I could describe this year in one word, it would be tumultuous.
If I could describe this year in one word, it would be challenging.
It's been a roller coaster year. I think there have been highs and lows throughout the year. There have been tough challenges, but we've also seen the resiliency of the people in our community pulling together.
Learning to put one's feelings or personal thoughts to the side in order to work with others within the community in order to get things done. The reality is that we're all not going to fully agree with each and everything the other has to say. We might not agree with a lot of things that go on with that person's life, but if we all have the same goal in mind, it can sometimes be challenging to put those feelings to the side in order to make great things happen. And I've noticed that, and I've learned that a lot of things have not happened here in Springfield because of that issue.
Hi, my name is Piero Tycho, and I am a Springfield entrepreneur, the communications coordinator for the Illinois Stewardship Alliance, and overall just kind of hustler of all things local foods. So one of my biggest passion projects I've been working on for the past couple of years is a community kitchen in Springfield, Illinois called Nourish Springfield. This year, it really hit its stride, and I think some of the pandemic and a lot of people thinking about the food system a little more critically is what may have opened up some people's eyes on the idea. I've helped coordinate getting a local food, local places grant from the EPA. That workshop was this year. It was very successful, and we're wrapping up our final calls on that. You know, I've heard the phrase, this pandemic has shown the cracks in our food system, like so many times this year. But I think a lot of folks forget the cracks we're talking about are people experiencing food insecurity. So that's food insecurity has definitely been something that's been on top of my mind lately. More people have experienced food insecurity this year because of our food system. And like so many other inequities that were exposed in 2020, BIPOC folk and the financially vulnerable are kind of the ones on the front lines. Just really showed that there's a lot of change still needing to be done.
My name is Allison Locker, and I am a Springfield-based visual artist. I work at the UIS Visual Arts Gallery as the exhibitions manager. Talked to a lot of artists. It's been a real time of assessment and reevaluation. Artists are wondering, what is this work for? Who is my audience? How am I reaching people with my work? Is my work important right now in the context of what's happening in the country with the pandemic, with Black Lives Matter, social injustice? I have been reflecting a lot on our visual arts community in Springfield. There are a lot of places to see and enjoy and buy art. We have the Illinois State Museum, the Visual Arts Gallery at UIS, the Art Association, and we have artist-run initiatives like the Pharmacy and the SAA Collective, and now the DIM Art House as well. And so I've been thinking a lot about the power of organizing and advocacy. And I keep wondering about what would happen if the visual artists in Springfield organized en masse and looking at things together as a group with common interests, determining what do we want to see, what do we all need as an arts community in Springfield? What do we prioritize and how do we advocate for that together?
I'm Katie Davison, and I'm the director of Innovate Springfield. We are the social innovation and business incubator for the University of Illinois Springfield. Obviously, there have been a ton of negative things that have challenged us this year, but it's also forced us into thinking about things in totally new ways. I think an advantage that our members have, because they're entrepreneurs, because they're already dealing in a kind of volatile market and situation anyway, they were very well prepared to pivot if they needed to pivot. That said, they, like everyone, experienced personal challenges that were probably not at the level that we saw and that we're seeing in 2020. So as Innovate Springfield, we really need to make sure that we are responding to those needs as well. So providing members access to resources that support their mental health. Many of us were working at a level that is not sustainable. And this time, this kind of great pause has encouraged us to really think about the core functions that we must do. If it's your business, you know, it's getting to your core function and staying there instead of trying to be everything to everyone. Or it's your personal life and it's your family and your children or, you know, your loved ones or yourself.
I'm Rachel Otwell, staff writer for Illinois Times. You're listening to community leaders in Springfield reflect on 2020, what's changed and what they hope for the future.
My name is Jonna Cooley, and I'm the executive director of the Phoenix Center, Central Illinois LGBT Community Center. We provide services including HIV, hepatitis C, and STD testing. And then we provide transitional housing. We have two programs. One is for homeless individuals who are HIV positive, and the other is for homeless individuals who identify as LGBT. New challenges that I've been made aware of include the fact that we take for granted just coming and going. Just hopping in the car, going somewhere. And so we've had to learn to be creative. We've had to find ways to reach people. We've had to find ways to get services to people, to take things to them. We've started doing deliveries, and we've created ways for people to come to the center through a walk-up window. And so it's been a challenge of isolation for our residents, because with the type of living we have and people sharing, community space, we've had to put some pretty strict rules in place. I just feel like during this time of COVID, we've seen a lot of good in people. We've also seen a lot of division. I'm hoping that when all is said and done and we're all able to get back to whatever the new normal is, that we regain that sense of community and that we see more charitable work, we see more people wanting to get involved to make a difference in our community.
My name is Erica Smith. I'm the executive director of Helping Hands of Springfield, and we are a local nonprofit organization that provides shelter, housing, and support services for people who are experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. Even before COVID, our organization really was working on providing more housing opportunities for people. We know that the answer to homelessness is housing, and while emergency shelter is very important, housing is the answer. So we were already really looking at how can we expand our organization and our programs to be even more housing focused. What COVID did was make that even more urgent. We knew housing is healthcare before COVID, and now we really know housing is healthcare. Just having your own house allows you to quarantine and really protect yourself and other people in a lot of ways. Even though there's nothing good about COVID, there were some blessings that came because of COVID. And one was we actually were able to get some funds we weren't expecting to launch a rapid rehousing program. Because our lobby had to be closed, we couldn't possibly have people in our lobby and keep them safe. We have redirected some of our services and our resources to our housing programs. And the priority this year that I've been working on helping our organization and guiding us to really expand and invest in our housing programs. We have committed to being a trauma-informed housing agency. And so I've been working a lot on what that means for us, how we will do it, and how we will sustain it.
I'm Veronica Espina with the Springfield Immigrant Advocacy Network. When the pandemic started, we realized that we needed to shift our focus and started doing direct service. A lot of our populations and communities lost their employment, and that employment wasn't well compensated anyway. So we started delivering food and meals, diapers, hygiene products, and so on. When we started delivering to specific neighborhoods in the city, we noticed right away that we were not only serving immigrants and refugees, but we were also serving marginalized communities that might have not fallen within our demographic. And so that awareness that Brown and Black communities share the same challenges oftentimes, and especially in times of crisis, is really important because it allowed us to work together and understand that the work that we do is intrinsically connected, and is connected because we believe that our communities have human dignity and we need to honor them by serving them well. I think that we need to acknowledge that resource sharing is vital. So I hope that Springfield changes the way in which we approach quote unquote business when working with marginalized populations, that we have to trust them, that we have to understand their needs by building this relationship with them.
I'm Dominic Watson. I'm president and CEO of the Springfield Black Chamber of Commerce. So this year has been met with a lot of challenges. Obviously, COVID put a dent in a lot of the way we did business. Specifically with Black businesses, there's always been a challenge in expanding scope and, you know, marketing to the greater population. Midway through the year, there was this shift. And the greater community was more open to supporting Black businesses, you know, which was an opportunity for Black businesses to really step up to actually showcase what it is they were already doing, you know, for years, for decades. In order to be better, we have to have every corner of our community better. And the continued lack of investment or disinvestment over in the east side of town is almost to a point where, I mean, it brings literally tears to my eyes. A lot of the programs, a lot of the organizations that service everyone aren't located or don't have satellite offices in the community in which Black entrepreneurs are living or operating. One of the challenges that we've tried to tackle is how can we bring our own business hub on the east side of Springfield?
My name is Michael Fallon. I am the director, CEO of the Outlet Mentoring Program. We mentor young boys that come from a single parent home in the Springfield and surrounding communities. It's been rough for us. You know, most of the young guys that I work with, they are already coming from hard situations. They're coming from, you know, not the best environment. So now tack on COVID, tack on doing school from home, you know, tack on maybe not having a meal that they would get from school, not having their friends around, not having that social interaction. It's been pretty rough. Yeah. I hope we come out of 2020 really with our eyes open and really ready to take action in our community. I hope our heads are not still inside the sand and I'll let my neighbor do it. I think until we as the community members take our place and use our voice, then nothing is going to happen. So we can't wait for the next person to solve what's going on. And it's not going to take an outside person. It's going to take us, I think, to change Springfield. I can't speak for other communities or other cities, but it's going to take us in Springfield to change Springfield.
That piece produced by NPR Illinois's Mary Hansen and Rachel Otwell of the Illinois Times. You're listening to Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The COVID-19 vaccine doesn't hurt. Take it from one of the first people in Illinois to receive the new drug. Doug Meyer is a respiratory therapist at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. He was one of the first five health workers in the state to roll up his sleeve for the shot on Tuesday.
If you're used to the flu vaccine, less than that. You barely felt the needle go in. You didn't feel too much pressure. And I didn't know really what to expect, but I was happy it was the lesser.
The first batches of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine arrived in Illinois on Monday, but it will likely be some time before the shot is available to the wider public. In the Peoria area alone, more than 8,000 OSF employees are already waiting for their turn to get the vaccine. Well, earlier we recalled the Bergner's chain, how it got its start in Peoria, and how it created holiday memories for generations of shoppers. Another former retail giant, Marshall Fields, holds a special place for those who frequented its Chicago State Street location, especially during Christmas time. Dazzling window displays and a whole lot more set Marshall Fields apart. For the WBEZ series Curious City, reporter Monica Ng tracked down the history of Marshall Fields.
Carolyn Cross's great-grandparents came to Chicago from Lithuania around the turn of the century. And even as newly arrived immigrants, they started participating in a Chicago Christmas tradition, visiting the Walnut Room restaurant at the Marshall Fields department store downtown on State Street. It all started when her great-grandmother took her grandmother.
And then my grandmother took my mom, and then my mom took me. So, you know, it's been a tradition in the family for a long time.
And that tradition, it's always included some specific steps. First,
when we were little kids, we would go see Santa Claus.
After that,
we would go look at the windows.
Then the best part, chicken pot pie at the Walnut Room. Now, if you're not familiar with this Chicago Christmas tradition, the Walnut Room is a huge, elegant restaurant on the seventh floor of Marshall Fields, now a Macy's. It's trimmed with Circassian walnut from Russia and flanked by white columns with a second-level balcony overlooking the main floor. And every year around the holidays, an enormous Christmas tree stands in the center of it all. Here's how Carolyn remembers it.
We would go have lunch in the Walnut Room and sit by that beautiful tree with those waitresses in their black dresses and their white aprons. It just had such great memories this time of year.
So this year, when a lot of us are feeling nostalgic about holiday traditions we miss, Carolyn asked us to tell her more about the famous Walnut Room, how it became a Christmas tradition, and why it still holds up. What we found was that the Walnut Room and that Christmas tradition was part of a larger strategy at Marshall Fields that went way beyond the holidays. A plan to make the department store accessible to all kinds of shoppers of every class and to make their store a nearly indispensable part of people's lives. But how did the Walnut Room start? Historian Sarah Sullivan says it all began with an impromptu lunch one afternoon at Marshall Fields at the tail end of the 1800s.
As the legend goes, there was a salesperson who was serving a group of ladies, and after the ladies had amassed quite a bit of merchandise that they were looking to buy, they felt they needed to cancel the sale and just leave because they were hungry.
See, at the turn of the century, women often had to go home when they got hungry.
Because the only place to eat at that time were in saloons, and saloons were not places that ladies would choose to eat. Also, there were no public bathrooms. So those two things prevented women from being as social as they were in later periods.
So when this particular group of lady shoppers at Marshall Field started to get hungry, they figured the shopping day was over.
So the salesperson, thinking quickly on her feet, said, oh, no, no, don't leave. Let me set up a table and some china and linens, and I will share my lunch with you. And that is what she did. She shared with them Mrs. Herring's pot pie. That was her grandmother. So she shared her grandmother's chicken pot pie.
And Sullivan says this improvised meal caught the eye of Harry Selfridge, the flamboyant Marshall Field's executive who was constantly dreaming up new ideas to attract customers.
Selfridge happened to see this all occur and realize that it made sense to put a restaurant in the store. Marshall Field's was not necessarily certain about this in the beginning because, of course, they were a retail establishment, not necessarily a restaurant. But they decided to take a chance on it, and it turned out to be a really good way to get more people into the store and to get more foot traffic through the store.
Over time, the little restaurant grew into a large tea room, serving corned beef hash, chicken salad, codfish cakes, orange punch and orange shells, and of course, that famous chicken pot pie. Historian Neil Gale says it was a while before they settled on a name for the restaurant. At first, it was called the South Grill Room.
Then it was known as the Walnut Tea Room, next to the Walnut Grill. And I guess they like changing names. And finally, it turned into the Walnut Room in 1937.
Growing up in West Rogers Park in the 60s, Gale says he started visiting the Walnut Room alone when he was still in grammar school.
At 8 years old, and you wouldn't do this today, at 8, my folks would let me go downtown by myself, the 155 bus and the north-south train, and I'd get off and I'd go shopping at Fields.
At this point, the Walnut Room was already a Christmas tradition for many Chicagoans. And when Gale came into the city on his solo excursions, he had a tradition of his own, a trick for managing the restaurant's notoriously long holiday line.
Many times there was a really long line for one or two people. And the line for three or more, you know, had 10 parties in it. And I was precocious enough to approach a family that looked nice and ask them if I can join them so I wouldn't have to wait an hour.
Wasn't that weird?
Yeah, but, you know, I met a lot of nice folks.
But remember, Carolyn's question was about how the Walnut Room came to be a Christmas tradition in the first place. And Sullivan says the answer is wrapped up in the evolution of Christmas itself. At the turn of the 20th century,
Christmas really wasn't the holiday that we know it to be. Santa was a figure that was known somewhat, but not every good girl or boy had a visit from Santa in that period. So all of it kind of gradually evolved. And Marshall Field's gradually evolved with this vision of Christmas. By the 30s and particularly the 40s, every department store had a Santa Claus, every department store had a toy department, and Marshall Field's was definitely a leader in the Chicago area in doing that.
The department store kicked off one Christmas tradition as early as 1907, when they put a Christmas tree in the center of the Walnut Room for the very first time. But that came with some complications.
When Marshall Field's originally had their Christmas tree in the Walnut Room, the initial trees were real, live trees. And they actually hired a man to sit all night and watch the tree to make sure that it did not end up on fire.
Remember, this would have been less than 50 years after the Great Chicago Fire, which destroyed their previous location. Then after they rebuilt and expanded on the same spot, another fire came along a few years later and burnt it all down again. So better safe than sorry. But
pretty quickly, it occurred to Fields that they should just invest in artificial trees, and that's what they had done ever since.
But for lots of Chicagoans, their Christmas memories go beyond the Walnut Room and the Great Tree. Some of us had moms who didn't want to deal with the long line at the Walnut Room, but we still got to see the dazzling Christmas windows, spectacular decorations with scenes that told a story each year. And Sullivan says Fields took those very seriously.
Fields was one of the first, if not the first, retailer to use store windows as a form of marketing. Prior to that, windows were only used to let light into the store so people could see what they were shopping for. And Marshall Fields got the idea to use those spaces for merchandising. And obviously, during the Christmas time, it became apparent that they needed to do that with Christmas decorations. So the Marshall Field store came up with a theme every year, and the windows and the Walnut Room and the store would be decorated using that theme for a given year. As the corporate lore goes, there was a department that spent an entire year acquiring materials and planning the design for the Christmas windows.
Over the years, those themes have included everything from The Night Before Christmas to The Nutcracker to a Marshall Field's Christmas mascot named Uncle Mistletoe. This year's theme is honoring first responders and essential workers during the pandemic. So in answering Carolyn's question, we've learned that the Walnut Room began when the department store tried to address an unmet need among female shoppers at the turn of the century. Then the restaurant evolved along with a bundle of Christmas innovations at the store, the giant indoor Christmas tree, the elaborate window displays. But historian Sarah Sullivan says those Christmas traditions are just a small piece of a larger customer service strategy that went way beyond Christmas.
In the early days in particular, Marshall Field's focused on the long game. They didn't look to sell something to you today. They looked to have you as a customer for life.
And they did that by constantly coming up with new ways to improve the shopping experience and attract all kinds of customers.
So they had higher priced items. They had less expensive items. They had a wholesale department. They had a retail department. And they treated everyone well, no matter how much money they could spend in the store.
The list of retail innovations at Marshall Field's is too long to get into here. But let me share just a couple of examples. First, Sullivan says they were one of the first department stores to accept returns.
This is a time when snake oil salesmen were a regular thing. So knowing that when you bought something, if it turned out to be defective, that the store would take it back was very reassuring for people. In addition to that, Marshall Field's was also among the first, if not the first, to open a bargain basement.
Yeah, you might think of Marshall Field's as a high-end shop. But they literally invented the bargain basement, a lower level for cheaper goods that became the largest sales floor in the nation.
Fields really hoped to address the needs of everyone. It gave everyone an opportunity to be able to afford something from Marshall Fields.
But Sullivan says the innovations at Marshall Fields went beyond retail. Their strategy involved establishing the department store as more than just a store.
They had long-distance telephone services at a time when people didn't have phones in their home. They had a post office, a telegraph office, stenography service, a travel agency, a concierge service.
And along with those services, they would often step up to help the community in times of need.
In many cases, they were the place that people turned to when there was a crisis, either a citywide crisis or a personal crisis. There are stories of people being trapped in blizzards, being stuck downtown and unable to leave the city and going to Marshall Field's. And people would go when they needed help, knowing that the store was going to provide that service for them.
So thanks to a long list of innovations in retail and an emphasis on community service and public relations, Marshall Field cemented itself as a Chicago institution and a national icon.
In 1914, Marshall Field's was the largest department store in the world. So people around the country would have known that Marshall Field's name, and it would have meant something. It was actually a destination for a long period of time. So what happened? Well, let me back up. Let me see how to, trying to figure out how to explain this. Well, the world changed.
Discount stores, online shopping, and most recently the pandemic have transformed the way we shop. But even with the decline of the department store in public life, every year around Christmas, the crowds do come back to the old State Street department store to take part in these holiday traditions, to see the great tree or check out the Christmas windows or have a meal at the Walnut Room.
The Walnut Room remains in great part because the place that Marshall Field's held in the lives of a lot of Chicagoans, particularly Chicagoans of a certain age. It was an important place to gather for a lot of Chicagoans for a long time. And I think that's why it's remained, even though Marshall Field's itself, the name has left, the restaurant continues.
The Walnut Room is still open, even during the pandemic, but with some changes. You can't dine in, but you can go check out the big tree and get a special holiday takeout box lunch with a brownie, an ornament, and Carolyn's favorite, the famous chicken pot pie. But even without the pandemic, the future of these traditions has been uncertain. In recent years, there were rumors that Macy's might sell the floors in the store that held the Walnut Room. But a spokesman said bah humbug to that rumor. In fact, she said, quote, "Macy's is a proud steward of these sacred traditions."
That's Monica Ng with that report on the former Marshall Fields in Chicago. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Follow us at statewideshow.com. You can find this show and past episodes there. Also look for us through the NPR One app, where our weekly podcast is available. Happy holidays from all of us. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.